Hi, listeners, and welcome to episode 7 of our Reading Cove podcast. For any listeners who may be interested in joining our book club, please visit our website at thereadingcove.com. Today, we're chatting about our July 2011 pick, The Kitchen House by Kathleen Grissom, and we're so excited to welcome Kathleen as a special guest for this month's discussion. So I'm Millennia, the Cove's founder, and this is the episode 7 of the Reading Cove podcast. And today we are so happy to welcome the author of our July pick, The Kitchen House, Kathleen Grissom. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And then we also have Roberta and Monica with us. Hi, guys.
Hi there.
Hello.
So let's just jump right in. We were talking about how readable this book is. So Kathleen, why don't you tell us a little bit about your inspiration with finding Negro Hill and what led you to the seed for this story?
Well, we were renovating. My husband and I had moved down from up north to find an old tavern that needed a lot of work. And it was in the middle of Southside Virginia, sort of in the middle of nowhere, what we thought was nowhere. And as we started to do the renovation, we really started to do some research as well. And that was all fine. And I really, as a Canadian, had wanted little to do with the study of slavery, even though I knew that our place had been built in 1830 and it was built of brick. So we knew that it had been built by slaves. The bricks had actually been made from the soil and from the clay in the area. So, but I just really, as a Canadian, as I said, I really didn't have to study that history when I was growing up, and I was reluctant to sort of go into that dark phase of history.
Right.
So, we were invited over to a friend's house who was also, she was from up north and had inherited a plantation from within her family. And she was down and she was renovating her home. And it was a beautiful place. And she invited us over for dinner one evening. And while we were there, she said, just go around and have a look and see, you know, what you think of the place. And she had inherited a lot of treasures, a lot of antiques and a lot of treasures. So I went to into the foyer, and she had an old map framed on her wall. On that map, I was able to see our place, which had been called Harvey's Tavern. And next to it, I saw this notation that said Negro Hill. And there was just something about that notation that I just really didn't know. I just responded to it in a way that was almost visceral. I just was pulled into it. And I immediately began to ask people who were also guests what, you know, why that would have been named that, what would have happened there. Because I knew the area, it was very close to where our house was standing.
Right.
And I knew that there weren't any buildings there or any markers or anything like that. So no one at this gathering knew anything about it. And then I began to ask local historians. And there were no collective answers. I wasn't given any collective answer. So I just kind of let it go. Then every morning I would go down to the bottom of our hill. There was a little stream down there. And I would meditate. And one morning on the way back, I was walking up the hill and I looked out in the direction of what would have been that area. And I just said out loud, sort of to the cosmos, what happened there? What happened there? And I came in the house, sat down to do my usual journaling, and for the first time ever, something happened where I had never had this experience before. It was as though I saw a movie playing out. And I just picked up my pencil and I wrote what I was seeing. And what I was seeing was this white woman running up a hill. There was a little girl behind her, and I knew it was her daughter, and she was trying to hold her back. The mother, the woman, I could feel her feelings, and I could feel the little girl's feelings. So I was sort of given privy to be almost inside of the bodies. And as we were racing up the hill together, I was filled with dread because I didn't know what she was going to see, but I knew it wasn't going to be good. And when we got to the top of the hill, that's where we saw a black woman hanging on a tree. And I just put it down and really wanted nothing further to do with it. I didn't know where it came from or why that came or why I had the story, but I just put it away in a drawer. And I really didn't want anything to do with it anymore. So I kind of let it go, and it was always sort of in the back of my mind, and I kept thinking, what? Where did that come from? I had journaled for years, and I had written children's stories before and a few other short stories, and I had done a journal and had worked on that. But I then called my father. I was talking to my father a couple of weeks later, and my father lives in Saskatchewan, Canada. And he was telling me about a friend of his that he was golfing with, and this friend was of Irish ancestry, and he was studying his ancestry. And this man was able to trace his family back to about 1790 when they came on board ship into Norfolk. And they had been from Ireland. On board ship, the parents died, and they left three orphans. And this man said to my father, we could find the two boys, but we couldn't find a trace of the little girl. And when my father said that to me, I just had this deep chill go through me. And I instantly knew that I knew what happened to that little girl. And I knew that that was her story waiting in my desk drawer. Wow. I don't know how I knew that, but I knew it inside of me. Mm-hmm. So I started to really do research. I did loads of research, and really I would say that I stretched it out. I was also running a tea room at the time, and I had an herb farm, and I was raising cashmere goats. Those were all of the things I was doing.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was living my dream, really. I just loved it.
Wow.
But this other thing just started to just keep bubbling up. So I did loads of research, and I still didn't know where to start. I didn't know how to start. I had never written a book before. And I knew it was going to be a story. So I went up. We have something here called Festival of the Book every year up in Charlottesville. It's just a wonderful experience where you have authors from all over the place come to read from their work. And that year I went up and I sat in the audience where Robert Morgan was reading from Gap Creek. I loved that book, had loved it at the time. And I couldn't wait to hear him read from it. When he started to read, almost immediately when he started to read, I just started to get chills because I knew that the answer was I was supposed to go home. He was reading in the voice of a 16-year-old woman, and he had written the story in the voice of a 16-year-old woman. And I thought, that's what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to let myself go into her and let her tell me the story and write it down. So I came home, and that's exactly what I started to do. So I was given all of the tools sort of in steps. And that's what I did. That's exactly what I did. Now, I wrote the first draft only in Lavinia's voice. And then later on, a person who read the book and whose opinion I really respected suggested that I include another voice, another African voice, African-American voice. Mm-hmm. And so I went back to the characters and I just thought, okay, jump in. Any of you can jump in at any time. And Belle just came forward and had a really strong voice. So I just let her talk whenever she wanted to talk, and I wrote it down. And that's pretty much how I came to write it.
Wow.
Long-winded, but there you have it.
No, but that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And it leads into the other question I wanted to ask, how long it took you to do the research, and then how long did it take you to write it? How altogether?
Well, because I was running the tea room and I had loads of other things going on at the time, I did this stretched out over a series of about 5 years. I think it took me about 5 years to do. Mm-hmm. And I cried my way through a lot of it. It was just a very difficult. I knew when things were coming up. I could sense them. I could feel them. And when I would try to change the story where something wouldn't happen or it would be a happier event, the characters would just stop talking to me. They would stop showing me the movie, and I was left to my own devices, so I quickly learned that I couldn't do that. So I would go back, and I would think, oh, I can't write this. It's too melodramatic. I can't, you know, I would try to hold myself back, and when I would do that, the story would stop.
So it was truly inspired.
For me, it really was. I called it a spiritual gift, and I still do today. It really was a spiritual gift for me. Yeah.
Well, that opening scene was very compelling.
Well, that was the scene. I think it had to be that for me, because I don't know that I would have latched onto it in the same way if it had just opened up with chapter 1, you know, in my mind's eye. Mm-hmm. If I had seen the movie that way, I don't know that I would have known what to do with it. But somehow I knew that I was supposed to go back in time and approach it from Lavinia, who was this grown woman. I knew I was supposed to go back in time in her story, and that it was really her story. So that's sort of how that came about.
I was wondering how you overcame the difficulty of writing the difficult parts, the kind of disturbing moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because the times when I really didn't want to go into the horrors of some of it, the way it was shown to me, the way I would sort of see the movie, it was almost always third person, because I am the kind of person who will not watch a violent movie. I have terrible nightmares from that. I just can't watch a violent movie. And I would be presented with this scene almost as though it was third person. So it would be, as an example, when Ben had his ear cut off, Belle told me the story, so I didn't have to be there and present for it. And I don't know if that makes sense or if you can understand that, but that's how those scenes came for me. It was almost as though third person.
That is a great lead-in to something else I was wondering, because mm-hmm. a lot of the scenes, or events, I should say, were told, like through yes. Lavinia would be telling you this yes. happened, and Belle would tell you that happened, and we yes. didn't witness it. And there were some scenes where I was like, oh, I wanted to be there to see that. Mm-hmm. Don't just tell me. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering what, you know, if you were deliberate in what you chose to show and what you chose to just have them tell us.
I think it was deliberate in the way it was presented to me, that I could stomach it, because I don't know that I would have been able to do that. Right. I don't know that I would have been able to go into real visceral detail, like the real gut detail. I don't think I could have done that. I don't think I would have had the stomach for that.
Wow.
That's the way I'm made up.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I'm the same way. So.
Are you?
Yeah, I can't watch violent. Yeah. Violent yeah. movies either. And I was kind of yeah. worried. I'm like, oh gosh, I wouldn't be able to envision something so horrific. I can mm-hmm. read about it, but I can't see or hear it.
Yes.
And I can, you know, kind of push the mute button on a book.
Yeah. Well, and that's when I come to a part like that or a passage like that in a book, if I do, I skim it. Or I'll sometimes just turn the page. I'll skip it because I just can't handle it. I'm not made that way. So I guess that's the way it was written that way, is because that was the way I felt it, and that's the way I received it. So that's the way I presented it then.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was sort of spared in many ways when I look at it that way.
Well, yeah, that does make sense, because I know what you mean, Kathleen. There's been books I've read in the past, which I can't tell you that much about the book, but there'd be some like horrible, you know, scene. Mm-hmm. It'll stay with me. Like you say, you almost have like flashbacks about the
exactly.
scene. Something never happened to you. But yes. That scene sticks in your head and you can't seem to get rid of it. It
exactly.
really does leave a lasting impression.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that we have so much, I mean, we're inundated with things today when you think about television and what suddenly will come up on the news, at
yes.
least for me, and you'll see something, at least sometimes they'll say, you know, be aware that there's something violent, we're going to show you something violent. But even with that, I can't get out of the room fast enough, or I can't turn the channel fast enough, because I don't need to see it to be able to experience or feel it. I understand what those poor people must be going through. But I just don't like the violence of it.
Yeah, there's some things that really haunt you, and they can
yeah.
they can haunt you for a while.
Yes,
I've
yes.
had that happen. That's why I don't read horror books.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because
yeah.
it bugs me for too long.
Yeah, me too.
Mm-hmm. But another question I had was about the relationship between Rankin and Mr. Waters. I
yes.
don't know if I really fully understood it.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I was just trying to read too much into it. But it just seemed in the beginning that they were, that maybe, you know, I was suspecting that perhaps Rankin knew that Mr. Waters was molesting Marshall. Mm-hmm. And then it seemed like maybe not. Maybe they were just, you know, two birds mm-hmm. of a feather that were just, mm-hmm. you know, comrades. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you about that. Was I reading too much? Was I looking for something that wasn't there?
Well, you know, that's all part of the, you know, the previous conversation that we just had. Mm-hmm. I was only given so much information. Right. And I don't know what happened behind the scenes. Now, if I had accessed Rankin's voice, I would have known all of the details. But I don't really know what happened when it wasn't told to me. So your guess is as good as mine.
I like that. So it's basically, you know, up to you to kind of imagine.
It is. It's for your interpretation.
Right.
Yeah. I just put down as much as I knew. And that was great sometimes because, like I said before, I was saved from having to see some of the details. But I don't know. I don't know what their relationship was other than what was written.
I liked how you left a lot to interpretation. Because, you know, in the back of the book, they were asking questions about what happened with Mr. Waters uh-huh. and Marshall. And, you know, you weren't really specific, but that leads us to determine what happened behind closed doors rather than mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. getting all the information in a book. We mm-hmm. have a little bit of imagination on our own. So mm-hmm. I liked that aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a little bit of ambiguity
mm-hmm.
in certain things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the way it was for me. That's the way I saw it. So that's the way I wrote it.
Now, will you write a sequel?
Well, funny you should ask. And I say that because I had no intention of writing a sequel. I really didn't. My next book was going to be about a woman, Crow Mary, who was this wonderful character who actually lived, and I was doing research on her life. Mm-hmm. And this past year, last year, I was out in Montana again, and I was doing research. And while I was out there, my agent has been waiting for Crow Mary. She really loved the idea of that book, and I knew that she was waiting on it. So I was really, I mean, I wanted to do it myself. I was very much into it. But while I was out in Montana and I was on the Crow Reservation, I was getting all of the details and I was getting all of the information, but I wasn't getting the feel. And I had started the book a couple of years ago and at that time definitely had the feel. So I knew it was there and I know it's accessible. But at that time, there was something blocking it. There was something blocking the feelings. And I think I write very much from feelings. So I came back and I called Rebecca, who is this dynamite, just a wonderful, wonderful woman who's my agent. And I said, Rebecca, I know that you're waiting on Crow Mary, but I think that Jamie isn't finished with me. I'm hearing his voice and I'm hearing Suki's voice. And they're on my shoulder, and I don't know what to do with them. And she interrupted me, and she said, Kathleen, that's your muse, and you must listen to your muse. So she gave me permission to then let these people talk. And, of course, they have a story to tell. So, yeah. So we've moved up to 1830, from 1810 to 1830. And if you know the story, Jamie killed his father.
Right.
And Suki was, and then he was, and then he left. So he was 13 when he left for Philadelphia. He escaped to Philadelphia.
And Suki was sold.
Suki was sold at the age of 13 as well. So I was writing Jamie's voice. Jamie is up in Philadelphia. He's 33 years old or around 33 years old. He's very wealthy. He's very, my daughter described him as a player when I described him. She said, oh, he's a player, Mom. I said, well, yeah, I guess he is. So he's pretty full of himself. But the real trick for him is that, he is black or part black, and he is passing for white in Philadelphia society.
Right.
Suki, on the other hand, was sold down south, and her life was very grim. Her life is very grim where I am with her now. So I was writing. It was as though I thought, well, I'm going to have part one, and then I'm going to have part two, but how this is ever going to mesh, I have no idea. These are two separate voices, two different lives, completely different lives, and living in two different parts of the country. And then while I was writing, I had a similar experience. Just one day, I had this little vignette play out, and I knew it was the prologue immediately. It was as though prologue was written in front of it. And it is Jamie and Suki together hiding out in a cave. They're running. They're escaping. And Suki is about to have a child. Jamie wants none of it. And he is sitting at the head of the cave and talking himself into leaving and leaving her for her to figure this out herself. Wow. Probably to die. And that's the prologue. Now, if you ask me how they come together, I don't have a clue.
It'll come to you.
Let's just hope so.
And I do you have a title yet? Because I certainly will be looking out for that.
Me too.
Well, I'll put you on my waiting list.
Let us know.
Yeah, I will. But I just have a working title called Bound to Go, but heaven only knows if that will stay. But that's what I'm working with right now. So that's again a long-winded answer to your question. Yes, I am working on a sequel.
Well, that's great.
I think it's a sequel. I can tell you that it's two characters from the same book, but I have no idea if other people are from the original book, from The Kitchen House, are going to be showing up. I have no idea. So,
I think they will. I think we'll at least hear about Lavinia's life, new life.
So?
I think so. What was it? Tall Oaks, and Belle decided to stay on with her. And mm-hmm. I think they'll come to you with how they are in 1830. They're
okay,
still alive.
Well, I hope you're right. And if I run into trouble, I'll give you a call.
Yes. And if you need advanced readers, give us a call.
Okay.
We're here.
Uh-huh.
But we don't want to hold you too long, but just a few more questions. Is it published in other countries? Do you hear from international readers?
There are a couple of other countries right now that, and I'm trying to remember where they are. I think Hungary and Norway, but I shouldn't even say that because I'm honestly not sure. There are two other countries that have picked it up, and so we'll see what happens with others.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And the reception has been really good. The reviews I've read have all been wonderful.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's been terrific, but I think it's been word of mouth with book clubs. Because the different book clubs that I've attended or the different people that I've spoken with in book clubs mm-hmm. have said that it's created very good discussion.
Yes.
And I guess that it might. So, yeah, the numbers are really good. It's doing really well. And I'm just, very, very happy with it. Very happy with the reception that it's received.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our discussion just started today. Right,
okay.
guys?
Right.
And
yes.
So it's already off to a good start. It is a very good discussion book, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it certainly brings up different issues, that's for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And do you have any favorite parts in the story?
I think the one that was the most meaningful for me when I wrote it was when Lavinia sort of had that breakthrough when they were burying the baby, and she kind of was, her memory returned to her,
mm-hmm.
and she was having difficulty with accepting the reality, and Mama came for her,
mm-hmm.
and Mama held her and rocked her and sort of somehow pulled this through herself and pulled the pain from Lavinia, and that was tremendously difficult and painful to write. I'm not sure why, but it was as though Lavinia was being reborn.
Right.
And I rocked and cried and rocked and cried while I was writing that. and it was just really, really difficult, but really meaningful. It had deep meaning to me. I'm not sure why, but it did. That was very, it had an impact on me. Yeah. Sometimes people ask who my favorite character is.
Mm-hmm.
And I surprised myself the first time. I was really surprised because I said Lucy. And they said, Lucy? And I said, yeah, you know, when I saw her, she was walking in silhouette with the new Ms. Martha
mm-hmm.
out the door. And at that time, as I was writing, I thought, she's like Mama May. She's going to be that strong character that's going to be helping other people through their difficulties. I just saw her as being so strong. And I always felt she was so generous with Belle overcoming
oh,
what
they
she had
a very interesting relationship.
Didn't
yes, they?
They
did.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
So, yeah, so I gave you an extra answer in there.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. And what are some of your favorite books and authors that you read?
Oh, do you know, I knew you were going to ask me that, so I wrote down.
You made a list.
Well, I had to because when people ask me that when I'm in a group,
uh-huh.
I go blank. I always go blank. I can't think of one darn book that I've ever read in my life.
That you loved.
Well, even that I loved or that I read, I go blank for some reason. Titles are just not my forte. But there, The Paris Wife I just finished, and I liked that very much. And I know that Alexandra Fuller, who wrote Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, has a new book coming out. I can't wait for that. If you haven't read Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, that's a memoir, and mm-hmm. I just love that book. It was so well written, I thought. Then I wrote, read Half Broke Horses.
Mm-hmm.
Can't remember who wrote that, but it's out
oh,
there.
Oh, Jeanette Walls. I said, yeah,
there
my,
you go.
My church book club's doing that this coming
okay.
month. I'm looking forward to it.
Mm-hmm, you should. It's really, it's a dandy little book. And then there's another good one, Blood, Bones, and Butter. That's a memoir as well, and I thought that was really done well.
Okay.
But there is something that I'm listening to. You know, the library here just started now where you can download books on your iPod.
Mm-hmm.
And then I walk every day. So this has been terrific for me with walking. I hook that little thing up and away I go.
Oh, that's great.
But there is a woman who wrote in 1898, I think she started, and it's Elizabeth von Arnon. Have you heard of her?
No.
Oh.
Well, she actually wrote, do you remember the movie years ago called The Enchanted April?
Oh, yeah.
It's one
yeah.
of my favorite. Right. Well, she wrote that. But she's written other books, and there's one that I'm listening to right now that's called Elizabeth and Her German Garden. And honestly, I am cracking up. I'm walking, and I think people are going to think I'm crazy because I'm laughing out loud. She just has this witty way of speaking. And it's just making me laugh. So those are a couple of books that I like.
Well, thanks. We'll have to look into some of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Are you reading anything now?
Oh, yes, but I don't have it in front of me, so I'm blank.
So you don't know?
Poof, gone.
Well, unless, you know, Monica or Roberta has anything more, we can let you go.
Okay. Monica, Roberta?
See, it was wonderful getting to hear about your inspiration for the book, and I loved it too. So I know we'll have a further good discussion in the Cove this week.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Great.
So I really enjoyed it. And I know you said slavery is a hard subject for you to venture into. But, you know, I'm a history major, and, you know, learning about it, you just get the facts. Mm. And with the story, you get emotions and you get feelings, and it makes it more personal. Mm-hmm. Whereas just hearing this is what happened, you actually get to see the helplessness of the slaves, like, you know, the one that got shot in the back when he was trying to get help for his dying wife and childbirth.
Yeah.
And when, you know, they couldn't stop Jimmy from being killed or beaten before, you know, you just see how helpless they are. And where you don't get that just from the straight facts.
And there was a really good part where Lavinia became aware of just how helpless they were. Because I remember that. It struck me when she didn't realize. I think she felt they had more power or more control. Mm-hmm. And there came a point when she realized, no, that wasn't so.
Mm-hmm. 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 The helplessness of it all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And poor Ben getting his ear cut off. And mm-hmm. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, so much, I mean, this is all based on history. It's all based on history that I've studied. So the really, it's the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
Really the tip of the iceberg. Yeah. And of course, for this second book, I'm doing research as well. So, but I've gone further down south, and that is where some of the more extreme behavior took place.
Yeah.
So, it's pretty grim. But also there are incredible stories of, hope, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the strength of the people as a whole. And women, how grim their lives were. They were so limited. It was really unbelievable.
And Lavinia illustrates that pretty well, too.
I guess so.
Mm-hmm. Very, I very so. Helpless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Restrained.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Kathleen. It's been
well,
a wonderful talk.
Well, thank you for
talk.
Having me. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
And good luck to all of you. It was great to meet all three of you.
And
thank
to you.
You,
too.
Okay. All right. You can always be in touch by my email.
All right.
Okay.
Have all a right. good Saturday.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.
All right.
Bye.
I know. Everybody was dropping like flies.
And when Dory died, I'm like, no, I liked her. And Jimmy died. And, you know, and well, Ash, everything Jimmy went through, it was just kind of like he got the, you know, brunt of the consequences in the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, they were going to beat Jimmy and kill Jimmy. And it,
and
you know,
it's
and
because
he would try to help him.
Yeah, I think it was he was from the fields. He worked in the fields, and you know, it showed the good distinction or the distinction that existed between the house slaves and the field slaves. And since Jimmy, you know, was from the field, they didn't want him with Dory, and I mean, it was real politics going on. But yeah, and then both he and Dory ended up dying. That was sad.
Yeah, so I liked Dory, and I felt bad, you know, when baby Henry died, and
was Henry just, the first one?
I think that was his name, the first baby.
The first
she
baby,
had
yeah.
Because
then she had Suki.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's right.
So yeah, that first baby was really sick, and then he died, and that's the one they were burying when Lavinia finally mm-hmm. broke down.
Right, and remembered her past. And I'm just, throughout the whole thing, I just felt bad for Jim until, because Jim couldn't see his baby.
And then, of course, the relationship between, as we touched on before, Belle and Lucy, that was interesting, right?
It was. I mean, you would think, you know, Lucy would be one to want to sneak up in the nighttime and do bodily harm to Belle. You know, I mean, when you couldn't have blamed her, you know, and but she really had. I could see why Kathleen liked her. The more you think about it, she really had a big heart. Lucy did, you know. She wasn't pretty like Belle, but she was a hard worker, and she was able to love people, you know, despite the circumstances.
Yeah, and then they ended up taking care of each other when they moved over. Well, I think they became friends before they moved to Will's plantation, right?
Right. Yeah, I think Lucy had, you know, already said, well, it's I know what's going on, but I accept it and I love you like a sister anyway. So, yeah.
Right.
They'd kind of, you know, made their peace.
I think all along she knew that Ben was in love with Belle, but due to the captain wasn't able to be with her. And it was kind of like, I'll just marry Lucy and just despite.
Yeah.
Belle,
and
like.
I felt like. The captain's, you know, the captain really wanted better for Belle, and I was so frustrated with her for holding her, for not grabbing that with both hands. It's like she was so stubborn. She really annoyed me. But it's like he was trying to get her life, give her, you know, as much opportunity as she could possibly get. You know, he didn't want her to, you know, mess herself up. He had plans to send her off to Philadelphia or wherever and try to get a better life for her. And she just was not having any of that.
that was her family.
It's true. Yeah, I know it was her family, but I don't know. She just seemed kind of silly to me.
Well, I think she's just kind of stubborn. Yeah, probably it's her family, but I think she was afraid of change or anything else. And
that's true.
And maybe it was partly, you know, a self-esteem issue, even if they didn't look at it at that time, that maybe she didn't think she deserved, you know, better.
Or who was she to live better?
Live better than these other people she'd grown up with, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was the same way with Lavinia said, they can't make me live in the big house. I don't want to live in the big house. I want to, you know, stay here with you, with my family. And
exactly.
I think that Belle had the same feelings. You know, she wanted to be with Ben. She wanted to be with Mama May and Papa George. And
yeah, it really showed that family has nothing to do with blood. And, you know, Lavinia, you know, the other thing that I had mentioned before in the group was how, you know, it illustrated so clearly how racism is taught. Because here comes Lavinia from Ireland, fresh off the boat, and she knows nothing of any difference between any different skin colors. And Miss Martha is going to make it her business to teach her her quote-unquote proper place. You know, to teach her that, you know, they're not the same as us and stuff like that. It's really sad.
Well, I mean, yeah, well, poor Lavinia was kind of caught in between there because she was white, but at the same time, she was basically, you know, the indentured servant for a long time because of her parents', you know, obligations.
True, but she was still white.
Well, yes, you know?
And that's what Miss Martha was trying to say to her, that, you know, oh, when I get back from Philadelphia, I'm going to teach you your proper place because you've been back there with these slaves and you're, you know, forgetting yourself, or you don't know any better than to start treating them like they're your equals.
Well, that's true.
So it's definitely something that's taught.
Of course.
Wow. I enjoyed the read, and the only, like I said in the group, the only thing that got under my skin was, as I mentioned, some of the scenes. It was just like so much was just summarized that I really wanted to witness some things that they were talking about. And of course, the misunderstanding. So much rode on these, you know, secrets dragging out and being kept. And it just seemed forced. Because, like, why would the captain not tell them the truth, that Belle was his daughter? Why let them think that he was having his way with her? It seemed worse to me to make them think that.
Yeah, I was wondering that, too, about, you know, why would he let his wife think he's cheating on her when that's really his daughter? But maybe they would have worried what they would have done to her knowing that he did have a illegitimate daughter with a slave. How they would react to that.
But it was happening all day long there. I mean, Rankin had a million kids with, I forget who.
Well, yeah, some of the other field slaves. Yeah,
Ida. Exactly. You know, it was going on. And so I just didn't, I still don't really understand why it was so important that he keep that secret. You know, it just seemed like it just made things worse, and it would have been easier for him and everybody if he had just said, okay, she's my daughter and that's why I show her special treatment. But, you know, they just assumed that, you know, he was going and having his way with her, and it just drove a lot of the rest of the conflict.
Well, it is a good plot device, though.
And then Lavinia assuming that Belle and Will were carrying on and that Jamie was Will's, and, you know, it was just,
Well, you know, people just draw their own conclusions a lot of times.
Yeah, but Belle purposely didn't tell anybody that Marshall had raped her.
Well, I could kind of see that, you know.
Yeah, I can understand that too, but she wouldn't even tell Lavinia. She wouldn't even tell them. You know, I'm not saying she needed to, like, tell to try to get him in trouble, but to try to keep it secret from even her family.
But when you're raised in fear and someone telling you, you tell and I'm going to cut off your breasts, you know, it's just, it's kind of like even what, you know, sexual molesters do. They say, you know, don't tell or I will kill your family. And they don't tell because of that reason, out of fear of what the person will do. And she's been raised in fear that, you know, she's seen, you know, they did slice off ends there, and they'll do it. They'll follow through on what they say they're going to do. And so I can understand why she didn't want to say anything to anybody.
I guess so. It just bugged me. It bugged me because I was like, you know, ugh. I really would have liked to see Lavinia and Will be together. You know, that would have been nice.
Yeah, yes. I thought that too when I read that. I'm like, oh, this story would turn out different if she just were to marry Will Stevens. And then I thought, well, then it wouldn't have been a story then if she did marry Will Stevens, and it kind of wouldn't have turned in the direction it.
Well, I think you still could have had a good amount of conflict because it's still 1810, and here she is in a very unique position. I really felt Lavinia could have been a much stronger character too, because she was coming in from that perspective of being an indentured servant and feeling that these people were her family. So she could have been a, you know, an early civil rights pioneer, you know, and that could have caused them a lot of problems. If she was with Will, that could have led to a lot of conflict, you know, because you still had Marshall over there and Rankin, who were big time troublemakers. So I think it still could have been good if she had married Will.
Well, yeah. I mean, that could have been another way for it to turn. That's true.
Yeah, but I understand what Kathleen was saying, that, you know, it was an inspired story and she just wrote what they told her. So
right.
I get that. Totally appreciate that. So anything else you guys want to share about it?
I think we've covered most, at least from my point of view. You know, I said I think it was well done. There's like different, as you said, there's different ways to look at things might have been, but I appreciate Kathleen's, you know, sharing how the story came to her and how she was able to, you know, deal with the different issues.
Yeah. Okay, so we will say goodbye for this episode and hope our listeners will come back for next month's episode, where we're discussing Poison Study by Maria V. Snyder, and she was kind enough to answer some interview questions for us, so we're really looking forward to reading that, right?
We sure are.
Yeah. Yes.
So thanks for listening. See you next month. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.